Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Pony Development Sync for Tuesday, June 4th, 2019. My name is Sean Allen. I'm the host today. And we also have Joe and Gordon with us. Joe, say hi.
Hello.
Hello. Gordon, say hi.
How's it going?
So hopefully from that little intro, you'll be able to recognize voices as we go along. If not, you know, What can you do?
We could announce everything we say by starting with our name.
Oh, yeah. This. Okay, that sounds awful. That sounds definitely awful. So getting started today, we have one RFC which has been updated. It was updated by me this morning. I updated the remove traits from Pony thing, which I said I would do back in January, and I finally did that. I feel like it addresses some of the stuff that was brought up. But
did you force push? You force push, so I don't know what you changed.
I've really, because it still shows it for me what they were. For completeness of the RFC, we can mention a couple of examples, so I added some stuff for that. Okay. I expanded the motivation section with a lot more background on some stuff, including the thing you can do with traits right now for open enumerations, right? And why I don't think that particularly matters. And then also addressed accidental subtyping slightly, but not particularly. So feel free to review it at your leisure. I feel like this is do we want to let it sit for a week and people can have a look at it, and then we could put it into final comment if there's nothing else? Should we do final comment now? Well, I don't know. What are your thoughts, Joe?
Sorry, I apologize. I'm late.
Hey, it's you. You have to introduce yourself so people will recognize your name, and other than just you.
Hi, I'm Sylvan Klepsch, and I'm late.
You are late. You're going to have to leave right on time, too, for that next meeting.
I am, yeah.
It's bad that I know your schedule. We are discussing, I updated the remove traits from Pony, so that's RFC 138. I added more about open enumerations and why the loss of that I didn't think was particularly problematic. How the open enumerations suffer from the expression problem, and at least a short little bit, which some people might want me to expand upon, about how I don't think the accidental subtyping thing that would be removed with by not having nominal subtyping with traits. Required nominal subtyping with traits is actually a real issue.
Yeah. So are people all comfortable with the whole cowboy widget problem?
So you're referring to the expression problem there, yes?
Well, no, that's the subtyping problem of if you tell something to draw and all you have is structural subtyping.
Okay, you're talking about that. Yes. Okay.
Cowboy? Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Okay, now I know what you're talking about with the cowboy widget thing. I'm like, wait, what?
Yeah. All right. Yeah, cowboy widget. And indeed, there are other things you can do, like marker methods, which is, generally speaking, how languages that only have structural typing overcome this, which they say, oh, the interface includes a method, which is also the name of the type that says, if you want it to be this type, you better really say that you are by including this marker method.
But even with that, you can still run into the same problem because you can have conflicts between where two things happen to pick the same marker method that has the same return value.
Yeah, I think it's okay to put this in final comment period. Okay.
All right. I will put it in final comment period.
For me now is like the only place where I might prefer like traits, like when I don't actually want an open enumeration, I want to close the enumeration, but I want to, I want the convenience of just attaching, you know, like as if I had like a union where I could attach, attach a type to that union, like from a distance. And I know from a distance is like a nasty word, but a nasty term. But like, you know, saying I have, you know, all within the same package, I have like five types in different files, and I don't want a separate, you know, declaration that they're all in the union. I want to just say, okay, this, each one, for each type, I want to say this is part of this union, and it's like a union that is temporarily open and then gets closed, and then you can use exhaustive match like you can't do on open enumerations. But I don't know. It's, that's totally a separate topic, I guess. It's just like, that's the only other reason why I might want to use traits.
Yeah, I touched on that in the RSC, and I think that that use case, I don't, I think that the affordances that traits give on that is actually kind of clunky. And if that's something that we really want to support, and I think there's a good conversation to have around that, we should look at what's required to make that not clunky in terms of it. Because with traits, you can sort of hack something in there, but it's like, you know, it's like, it's like, hey, okay, but now, you know, for the most part, when I use this, if I use type with that closed union, then with the matching, I can be like, oh, okay, I don't need an else. But like by the default that you would use with a trait, you still need to have an else, right? Because it could be.
Yeah, I agree. Traits are insufficient for that use case because they don't let you have exhaustive match.
Yep. Yep. And I would very much like to have, I would very much like to have the conversation about like open, like some type of open enumeration thing and what the trade-offs are there, because it appeals to me on a certain level to be able to do that. But how that would actually function, I'm not entirely sure. So yeah, I think that would be another a good one there.
I have a question. I forget, can interfaces have default method?
Yes. Yes, they can. They can do everything that traits can, for the most part, almost everything. About the only thing that they can't really do is the open enumeration thing, because without putting a marker method in, right? You'd have to have a marker method to do, which basically makes the open enumeration thing, crazy clunky then at that point. Right, because if you have an interface which has no methods, everything matches that, and it's not. Then it's not. You can't use it as an enumeration. Well, you. No, you couldn't. Yeah.
Type safety goes right out the window. I would just like to point out that Joe's mic is too quiet because his singing just wasn't loud enough.
Anything you can do, I can do better.
Thank you.
I can do anything better than you. All right, we've already hit the high point of this meeting. In theory, we should end it now, but I'm not going to.
Sad.
Okay, let me update the last week in Pony comment for this. Edit has been updated and moved into final comment period. Yes. John Mum says he's going to come along with something that he's going to write up to go along with this. John Mum believes that as part of this change, that interface should be renamed to trait.
Interesting. I'm not against that.
I'm not for it, but I was like, I think you should make that argument, you know, and definitely if it's going to happen, it should happen at the same time that this does.
Yes, indeed.
Not after.
Yeah, that would be comical, but yeah.
Okay, no more trait. Okay, now there's trait, but no more interface. But it's like the interfaces, but they're structural typing.
Possibly as part of this, we should consider not the same RFC, but to make a change at the same time. I have some ideas about code reuse scenarios that are not subtyping based and are not composition based. That's a separate thing. I'll try and run that by a few people and maybe write an RFC if people think it's a good idea.
I'm
it sounds like you're going in the direction of like something where I want to copy methods in, but without expressing a subtyping relationship.
That's right. Yeah.
That's absolutely something that I care about. Yes.
Oh, so like this, is this revolve around the mixins conversation type thing that we've been having forever, Sylvan?
That would be the one.
Yeah. Yeah. Did the Lori code that I show you help inspire you some?
Yes, definitely. And other things. Yes. I mean, it's been, and talking to Joe and like a whole bunch of stuff.
And you've been writing C++ and now you miss multiple inheritance again.
You don't have to be rude about it.
Yeah, come on. Funny.
So yeah, I don't want to derail stuff, but basically, please tell me to stop because this is a bit derailing. So, but if we divorce the concepts of subtyping and code reuse, we could even get the ability to say mix two classes together, much less an interface in a class, and say, oh, look, here's a new class. Is it a subtype of either of those other classes? No, it's not. But it begins with the members of both classes mushed together. And then you can override to eliminate ambiguities, and any ambiguities still present after overriding are compile time errors. Yeah, roughly speaking. And being able to do that over both over classes and interfaces, and I suppose and traits, if we leave traits in the language, might be pretty interesting that it happens without a subtyping relationship.
I think that's definitely something that you should write up. You know, I've been saying for a long time, I think the code reuse properties in Pony for how everything came together. Everything was really nice in theory, and you put it together and the code reuse properties kind of suck. I'm allowed to say sucks about something in Pony because it's a language that I'm actually responsible for helping to improve, right? It's an emergent property that I wouldn't have expected until I actually started using Pony. If you said, hey, it's got these five features, I'd be like, awesome, that's great. That's exactly what I want, you know? So, yeah, definitely interested in that. The part I would be most interested in is the what is the ramp up for new folks learning this look like? I think that's, at least right. For some of the stuff that you and I have talked about, that was always the hard thing that we started to get stuck on.
Yep, I agree.
Cool. Cool, cool, cool.
Yeah,
all right.
Speaking along these same lines while I've been working on compiler stuff, I kind of already separated the concepts of, in the compiler passes of, you know, the compiler I've been working on, I've already separated the concepts of copying functions from the subtyping. It's like two separate sort of properties that when you use an interface, they kind of both come along together, but you don't have to do it that way. It's just like kind of a implementation right. Detail for the front end parser or whatever.
Okay. That's very interesting. Yeah. Another thing to mention is, along with the idea of calling interfaces traits, there's also the possibility of eliminating the concepts of both classes, of both traits and interfaces, and saying that the class and the final class. And so classes that cannot be subtyped are final classes. Classes that can be subtyped are classes. So there's a lot of different possible terminology. I'm not saying one is better than the other, but just that if John wants to argue for some changes, I'm totally open to that.
The purpose of doing that would be so that what is now interfaces could hold fields.
Yes.
Okay. I would anyway. I don't want to derail too much, but I would maybe just argue that interfaces having fields is not a bad thing. You don't have to rename them to classes to make it happen.
Totally, yes, I agree with that. Absolutely agree with you. Sorry, yeah, I should have been clear. The terminology about what we call them, I think, I'm fine with them just being classes and interfaces. I think that's fine. If people want to argue for other stuff, I just want to say that there are many possible schemes. It's okay to have a big discussion about it, right? That's all.
Yeah. John's argument against interface is basically the typical understanding that people have of interfaces before recent changes to other things, an introduction of some languages, is that an interface is purely the behavior and nothing about implementation, right? And that due to weaknesses in wanting from a practical standpoint of wanting to be able to attach a default implementations, et cetera, to things like that for code reuse, that was added in later, and that it overloaded interface as a term in a way that's not particularly helpful for conversation.
Yeah, that seems very reasonable. And this is why Gilles Braque's work all talks about it as traits. So I'm open to that for sure.
Yeah, I agree with that point. Also, I'll add that trait is a shorter word and fewer letters for me to type. And aesthetically lines up with the word, like if I have a trait in a class next to each other, it's the same number of letters and they line up aesthetically, and that's all very nice.
Well,
it sounds sad, but I agree, and I actually really like that.
Also, when you have a 5-letter keyword for the type, then when you add the 3-letter keyword to two spaces indented, that perfectly lines up as well. So you have like class val and fun val. The val lines up, and it's all beautiful and immutable.
Okay. Wow. While we're derailing, Sylvan.
Yeah.
I have one more for you. Okay. Going to code reuse, and I think this might be part of what you were thinking of, but I'm not sure. Right. The distinction between actor and class. Right. An actor can have behaviors which are asynchronous and its construction is asynchronous, and that's really the difference between a class, that right? And from a code reuse standpoint, like, well, if I have code that's in an actor, why shouldn't I should be able to reuse it in theory somewhere else. This goes back to like the RFC that Joe opened up. I think that was like 18 months ago for wanting to reuse code from one actor to another. I think there's something to look at there as well for that.
I wouldn't necessarily merge class and actor together, but I would say that if we're going through the scheme that you can copy code reuse from a class, then code reuse from an actor would also be allowed, I would think.
Oh yeah, for sure.
But only into an actor, right? Because you can't reuse behaviors into a class. That would just be
right. Yeah.
So let's see where it goes, because I think the first thing I would ask that you do in that RFC, Sylvan, right, is lay out what the goals are, right? And then we could discuss different ways to hit those goals, which might be different than the ones that you have there. Because, like, one of the things, you know, that I hit at a certain point was I was like, I could use primitives for this, right, where primitives are basically kind of like, you know, OCaml modules in disguise.
Primitives are first class.
Yeah. But I was like, you know, what I'd really like to have is a way to join different modules together. But the thing with primitives is that one, primitives don't have, they don't have behaviors. They only have functions. Actually, no, you can have a behavior, can't you?
No.
No, you can't. And they have no fields, right? And it's like, oh, right, you know, which is basically like at that point, it's like, I would like to be able to use a primitive or a module as a thing where I can kind of do mix and blah, blah, etc. Anyway, I'm back.
Another thing that we should contemplate while we're rat holing on this, I'll just pile in. We could eliminate primitive. We could say that any concrete type, right? So once you've got a class, however you've assembled it, that has no fields, is a singleton type. There's only ever one instance of it, and that eliminates the need for primitives at all. And it makes it a little bit more obvious that a primitive is a first class parameterizable module.
So I think the issue, let's
keep that hole going.
So we need that 7th reference capability. I've talked to both Sylvan and Sean separately about this, but I believe that a primitive is not val. I believe that a primitive is a seventh reference capability that more accurately represents, like, because a val is an immutable object. Like the fields on it are immutable, and like carrying, like, val comes with this like connotation that you can read from it, And like, because Val is some type of box, right? You can't read from a primitive because it's meant to read.
But you can read all of its fields, and all of its fields are immutable.
Okay, so Sylvan, you could also write to all of its fields. I can write to any of a primitive.
That's absolutely true.
I was waiting for that part to be the rejoinder.
I'm pretty sold on the idea that like a primitive is not a class without fields. It is a type, and it is a type that you can like reference at runtime, and that type is a singleton. And it just so happens that that type cannot be constructed. So some types can be constructed because they have fields, and some types, you know,
I actually disagree with this.
With their primitives.
So this is the difference between a first class module and something that is not a first class module. And I think it's critical that we have the ability to express first class modules. And the reason is instances of primitives, which implies that such instances exist and are constructible, are subtypes of other things, and therefore you can pass a primitive as a subtype of something else. And that is effectively what distinguishes a first class module from a non-first class module.
Yeah, so I don't think I'm losing that in my proposal here. I've been calling the seventh reference capability non, maybe that's a bad name, but.
It's no worse than any of the other names.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's non-instantiated, and basically what it is every type can be referenced as a value in the program, whether it is a primitive or not, and it has a reference capability of type non, and when you it could be a subtype of an interface non, it can be used without instantiation. The only thing that I don't think this breaks anything regarding the first classness of it. The only thing that it possibly breaks is stuff related to capability security.
So if I have an interface which has some method M,
right,
and I have a class that has some method M, and I have a primitive that has some method M, and I have some other type that has a field whose type is this interface that has method M. Am I able to dynamically inhabit that field sometimes with some object and sometimes with some first class module, i.e. primitive?
Yes.
So it is instantiable because it has a memory address.
Yeah, it has a singleton memory address like a primitive, but it's not.
Right.
It's not instantiated, like it is a singleton instantiation rather than dynamic.
But to be clear, that means it's instantiable, right? It's the one big button that we pressed at the factory for you, right? We instantiated it at compile time. There it is. I just want to make sure that I'm clear on this, because when you say non-instantiable, that's what leads me down this road of thinking that it's not a first class module. So I just want to make sure that I've got this right. That's all.
Yeah. So yeah. Yes. It is. Okay. It is a memory address to basically like the type descriptor.
Right. Yeah. Such that effectively, it's an object just like any other object. Here's its one and only instantiation because it has no fields, so it's meaningless for it. It's like seven, right? There is only one seven. There are not many sevens. There's only one seven. Every single seven has the exact same layout in memory as all other sevens, just like every primitive foo has the same layout in memory as every other primitive foo.
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
So the other interesting thing you can do is you can have a fun non on any type. So for example, like this is how I've been doing, you have, when we have the numeric machine words, like we have like a constructor that takes the value, like just as a way to infer it, right? To assist with things. So rather than that being a constructor for that machine word primitive, it can now be a fun non that takes the value and just, you know, uses that for inference, right? So it works the same way, but like fun non is appropriate for things that like that you don't need anything but that singleton reference to the type to do. And like you just call fun non rather than making it be a constructor. And this solves some cases where in the past, like I have wanted to have, and I think maybe others have too, like singleton methods attached to classes. And it does it without, you know, doing this thing where like, okay, now you have some methods that are attached to the class and some that are attached to the instance. Like they're all attached to an instance because, as you said, like the singleton is an instance. It's just one that can't be created by the user. It's created at compile time.
Right. Yeah, that's interesting. That's very interesting. And then you have the idea that there is the possibility of having an interface that has only fun non on it, and therefore you could pass, even though you have some class that has many fields, you could pass a class like that without instantiation, so it's the type as value.
Yes.
To fulfill that interface.
Right.
Yep, I think that's interesting. I think now we're really rat-holing, but I think that is especially interesting in the context of thinking about compile time reflection. So for a long time, I've been thinking about capability secure reflection and how you do it. And generally speaking, my thinking right now is don't do dynamic capability secure reflection. But compile time, static capability secure reflection, is possibly a feasible thing and gives you, roughly speaking, almost everything you want out of dynamic reflection. Maybe, I hope. And I think this might be an interesting way to look at that, because if we start talking about instantiating a mirror at compile time such that you can start to reflect, well, what would you mirror over? Well, it would be one of these, type as value.
Yes. Yes. And it comes back to the dependent typing that Luke Cheeseman worked on. Because you can, in that sort of like compile time pseudo runtime environment where you're creating these compile time constants, you could have access to the fun non of a lot of different,
right,
which and I think
it's not safe, but everything's fine. Yeah.
So that was fun. Anyway, so but my main point there was like, I don't necessarily want to say that a primitive is the same thing as a class, because okay, so talking, so in the, so picture we're in this world where we have this non-reference capability, and you want to do something like ambient off, right? Before we were relying on the idea, okay, you use a primitive constructor, you use a primitive with a constructor that's like private to make it so things outside the package can't instantiate that can't instantiate the primitive, and therefore the primitive can be used as a token. Like,
or I think, the constructor takes an argument, and you must have one of those capabilities in order to construct it.
Right. Yep. Constructible primitives is something that, like, so if we think of primitives by default as being non, right? Then like this world where you use primitive constructors. A primitive constructor is no longer a coherent thing in this world, right? So for those cases where we want the capability security sort of pattern, you would want to use an empty class to do that. So there's a distinction between class with the constructor and a primitive, which is inherently this sort of like singleton that
requires no construction. Done at compile time without memory allocate dynamic memory allocation. So you still want to have a singleton type in order to do this. So that makes me a little nervous.
Well, that's just a compiler optimization, right? The singleton type for...
No, it's not. It has to do with object identity.
Yes, okay.
So it's not just a compiler optimization. There has to be a clear language semantic for when something is a singleton type.
Yes. Yeah, so So for capability security, I think, in the system that I'm proposing for capability security, you would need a different kind of primitive. You've got like a capability security oriented primitive versus this sort of, you know, not that, like this sort of like globally accept anyone can access the non of any type that they want.
What goes wrong if you say, that actually you do need to construct in order to get at that non? Oh, I see, because of the specific instance of having a non on something that is not a primitive. Never mind. Yep.
Yeah, like you would maybe need a different concept, like rather than calling that construction, you call that like some, you know, like access control thing. Like, I don't know what to call it, but like rather than being construction, what that really is access control. Like you must have this to get at this, right? And I know access control is the wrong name because it implies the opposite of capability security, like access control list or whatever.
Sure, but I know what
it's mean. It's like you
visibility more than anything else.
Something like to reach this, you must have this, and by default, a primitive has no reachability requirements, and then you do something, some annotation to add a reachability requirement to it, which could be done on non-primitives as well.
Okay.
There's a long trail of digression there, but.
So, in the absence of the non keyword, hypothetically, I think it's pretty straightforward to get rid of primitive if we wanted to and say that all classes with no fields are in fact singleton types. It's a straightforward semantic. Essentially, it just it removes a keyword from the language without actually changing the semantics of the language at all.
Well, it changes object identity.
Sorry?
Like you mentioned. It changes object identity, like you just mentioned. It, like previously.
Class with no fields. So the only thing that it changes is if you have a class with no fields where you want every instantiation to be a separate object identity, now you can't, and you have to add a marker field, essentially, that says, here's a field, now everything will get a new identity.
That kind of sucks because, like, using this empty type as a field, especially, well, I don't want to say that, but it's sort of like a class without fields sort of has the same use case as, like, Erlang's make ref.
Uh-huh.
And if you have to add a field to that, you're getting memory inefficient for no reason.
Actually, you're not. Under the hood, you're not because of the memory layout. I mean, theoretically, you're absolutely right. Practically, it turns out it's exactly the same because of minimum allocation size. But you're still right, right? Yeah,
and you know, you could argue that the make ref is sort of obsolete in Pony because you can kind of use tag for that, but yeah. I don't necessarily want to rely on that.
Yeah.
Dot, dot, dot.
Dot, dot, dot. Dot, dot, dot.
Yeah, it was a good dot, dot, dot. Yeah, okay. Yep. That's very interesting.
Okay, sorry. The long trail of digression, which I am partially but not wholly responsible for.
I'll take credit for the rest of it.
Hey, I get some credit too.
Oh, damn it. Okay.
I get some too. All right. Shall we try to get through a couple things? We don't have many before we go.
Sounds good.
Okay, let's start with 3161.
Desperately clicking 3161.
Six memory leaks identified by address sanitizer.
Is There it is. Thank you.
Everybody good with this?
Just doing a quick read through. You bet.
And Dippin did a manual test of a basic SSL thing with what's in examples.net, and it still works. Which I wanted to check on because we don't have any automated tests around that.
That's true. Yeah. Great.
Yo, you good?
Yep.
Sweet. All right. And we have 3167. Do not permit leading zeros in JSON numbers.
Oh.
There's an RFC for this, even.
Very good.
Well, there's not an RFC for it, but there is an issue.
Comes with tests.
It was a great first-time contribution. Thanks.
This is fabulous, and I would like to point out.
This person might never hear. Type "this is fabulous" into the window thingy as well.
I'm doing that now. So, Luke as Rogers. All right. Putting a comment. Thank you very much, Lucas Rogers. This is absolutely right. Nailed it for the RFC 8259. It came with tests. Hell yeah.
I'll do the hell yeah. Well, do you want to? All right, I'm going to merge this. All right.
Yep.
It even has a reference to the RFC number.
Yeah. Our changelog bot is broken. So I'm going to update that right now. Give me 1 minute, right? Pull.
Broken robot.
Yes, broken robot.
Broken for two reasons at the same time. That's even more fun.
Okay. What was that PR number?
3167.
3167?
Correct.
Okay, 3167. Okay. All right, updated for that. Boom. Okay, good. Pull request. Let's see. We also have 3164. Diffin opened up. This is looks like at least Diffin found that some of our tests that are run by gtest only pass based on the particular order that they happen to be run in. So we have this PR open, which would shuffle them. But right now, it fails where it looks like there's probably some things that we need to fix up before we merge this.
I am highly in favor of this. Order-dependent tests, I assume this is probably my fault, and I'm sorry.
Comment away.
Huh?
Comment away as well.
Yep.
Yeah, so my thought was that, you know, we merge, we keep this open until we fix all of the order dependent stuff. It all passes and it merges, and then we merge. Yep.
Looks like there's only one order dependency issue. Build flag set test dot user flag undefined.
Yeah, that I'm not sure that might have actually been fixed in something else, and this needs to be rebased. But I'm not sure. I think it actually isn't. No, that's right. This was causing a fail, so we broke it out into. He had one large PR that had many things, including this commit, and we broke it out into individual ones so that this could be addressed separately and the others could be merged. And most of them were already merged, with the address sanitizer was the last one.
Cool. Literally one test. User flag none defined. Out of the whole thing.
Shuffle.
Sorry?
I said, at least in this particular shuffle, we're not guaranteed to see all the order dependent tests in any given shuffle.
Extremely good point.
Yes.
Which is something that I kind of don't like about test shuffling, but I agree there are, yeah. It's so kind of inside in my mind that, like, if you're trying to troubleshoot a problem, you're not guaranteed to reach it again the next time you try to do it, which is somewhat annoying.
That is true. So this is why John Hughes, the guy who, well, one of the people who invented QuickCheck, talks a lot about randomized versus deterministic testing. But he comes down very firmly on the side of randomized testing, exactly because deterministic testing, you will expose exactly a specific set of bugs, and that is all. And with randomized testing, you at least have a chance of exploration over time.
If you have like a random seed that you can be printed and then reused again, like yes. Say, okay, well, this failed with exactly. This particular random seed, I'm going to rerun it with the same seed.
Yep.
Otherwise useless.
Yep.
Oh, look, a thing will fail in conditions that I don't know what they are that I can't ever reproduce. Wonderful. Yeah. Welcome to life.
Please do not enjoy your stay.
So we have 3156, which is still open. At this point, basically, the way that we support the different open SSLs is kind of nasty and ugly. And I personally like to, over the course of time, I've said this before, I would like to kick the regex library. I would like to kick the SSL stuff, et cetera, out of anything which requires linking to an external library. I'd like to kick out of the standard library and have a way to deal with that in whatever our version of like crates becomes with a build tool and everything. But in the meantime, I feel like for this right now, simply saying having updating the makefile so that you can use 1.1.1 and it's a hard-coded value rather than saying you can use any 1.1 seems sufficient for the moment. Yeah?
I agree. This solves a real problem now, even though we're aware that we have a larger problem that we also need to solve.
You good with that, Joe?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, so.
Esperantis. Yeah, we discussed sync and adding in hard-coded 1.1.1 as another option in the file is fine. Let us know when ready for merging.
Okay, that is our pull request. Oh, Sylvan, 3130. I don't think we have time right now, but Dippin did respond to your comments on that. They're rather extensive, and I think you should review them and comment sometime this week.
I assume you mean 3031?
3031, what did I say instead?
Doesn't matter. Cool. Thank you, will do.
All right, trying to crank through here. A note on 3140, I brought this up, but this is definitely not Docker specific. It's not, and it's not the bug. So for 3140, the an open question on this was, is this a 7.0.1 bug, or is this possibly related to the ABI problem, which we're seeing, which caused LLVM 7.1 to be released. I tried doing this with the fully vendored LLVM, and this is definitely, it's we definitely have a bug related to LLVM 7.0.1, which somebody would need to look into further. Definitely a bug there. It's on both Linux and Mac OS from when I tested.
Okay. I apologize. This is still visible on 7.1.0 as well as on 7.0.1?
I have not tested on 7.1.0. However, the ABI issue which 7.1 is supposed to address, which is the only thing that it addresses, right, would be where if you're using, in the particular case for what Epic Eric was doing, was he was using the pony inside the container, right? And there were some ABI problems with using different versions of GCC, right? Different compiler versions of GCC were causing problems with the 7.0.1 series.
Okay.
Where you get interesting errors, which was fixed in 7.1. This happens using Clang as well, so it's definitely not that issue. And so 7.1 shouldn't have any impact on it, given that 7.1 only fixes one issue, and it's not a tiny point release because it actually fixes an ABI problem and is technically a breaking change for folks. Speaking of which, there is an issue 3166 open for figuring out how we're going to do LLVM 7.1 support.
Okay.
So if anybody wants to chime in on that, somebody already did was like, hey, I've created some LLVM 7.1 CI packages. I need to look at them further, but they might be helpful for our CI, which would be nice to grab those.
Yeah, yeah. That's extremely good.
Indeed.
Yes, the long-running issue of how best to use LLVM.
Hmm. So, speaking of that, we only have a couple minutes left, which is the I'm just about at the point where I can start doing the our move from using the prepackaged and system LLVMs, right, towards building our release packages where we do not use those, but we use ones that we've built ourselves, which could then avoid the problems. And I think, so there are two things I was thinking about is the question would be is, do we want to build using the vendored LLVM and just ship Pony C, or as another possibility is, do we want to be building? Rather than doing that and just building those, do we want instead to be rather than it's each time we do a release? Do we want to have Docker containers which could be used as part of all of the Linux releases there, which would then be used to build the Pony releases at such that, like, if we're using 7.0.1, there's not necessarily any reason, if we don't change any of the other dependencies that we're using to build, there's not necessarily any reason to rebuild for each release the LLVM.
That's right.
The thing with that is, though, is like, if we start doing packages for something other than Linux, that we might go back to another thing. And also that
building Docker containers that then get used for something else. It could be, you know, we'd want to have a machine that we can do that. And I tried building LLVM inside of a Docker container on my computer, and it takes like an hour and 20 minutes just to do one. So that would be really expensive. And there's a lot more movement there. I'm thinking of just doing the hey for each release right now. We build LLVM each time for the release and go for it. Any thoughts from either of you?
Tempted to write my entire own instruction selection and optimization backend. Clearly, I will never do that. Yeah, that sounds fine. This is fine.
Okay. The other thing, Sylvan, you're probably aware of this by now. So the decision was basically at this point was going to come down between trying to use the Azure DevOps pipeline stuff for this, right, versus using BuildKite and taking some of our Open Collective money and having it spent on large machines, which could build LLVM quickly when we do releases. I found a wonderful thing, which is currently part of DevOps pipelines, where if somebody who's part of your organization has not been logged in within the last 5 minutes, your account is considered dormant and your jobs are shut down, which I think is a non-starter for us right now.
So
what?
This is so insane.
And somebody who works on the Azure team, I saw them confirm that this is actually the case.
So your automation only works when humans are involved?
Yes.
Okay.
I know for a fact that we have many, many, many DevOps jobs running here at the lab.
And what organization are you part of? Microsoft?
That'd be the one, yeah.
Okay, so... What?
Is this by organization?
Yes. So somewhere, everywhere in the world then, probably, there's somebody always logged in?
Oh my God.
Right?
Okay. Can you do me a favor?
Uh-huh.
I'm trying to think about the right way to raise this internally. No, you know what? Let me figure it out.
So somebody who's a Azure person, the way that I stumbled across this was a conversation that was happening on Twitter, and there's somebody who was on that Azure team who was like, yes, this is true. This probably resulted from something in the past. Yes, this is something that we're going to look into.
Okay. So they're at least already looking at it. Thank you. Okay.
Yes. But it doesn't really help for any short term thing.
No,
for this. For
this is pretty upsetting. So
the
much like Azure DevOps to be a first class contender for open source projects, and this is not the way to do that.
Yeah. So, Joe, the particular bit of documentation from their stuff is, my build didn't run. What happened?
Okay.
Explanation. Someone must view a page in your organization regularly for CI and schedule builds to run. It can be any page, including, for example, Azure Pipelines. Your organization goes dormant 5 minutes after the last user signed out of Azure DevOps. After that, each of your build pipelines will run one more time. For example, while your organization is dormant, a nightly build of code for your organization will only run one night until someone signs in again. CI builds of other Git repos will stop until someone signs in again.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. As Sylvan said, that needs to be fixed if it's going to be a serious contender. So, yeah.
Yep. That was
open source projects, but anything like where somebody wants a build to run overnight.
And it's a small organization. If you have two things,
that doesn't span the globe, right?
Mm-hmm.
Even a very large organization that is entirely on site in one particular location. It doesn't have people logging in at all hours of the night, can't run an overnight job.
Well, they could run one. That's what it says. You can run one additional job after you go dormant.
Okay.
Then nothing else will get run.
I had the perfect idea. In your one job, you log in to you log into Azure and at the end of your job, and then that gives you another one.
You have a scheduled build that logs in every 10 minutes. every 4 minutes.
Yeah, I'm sure there's a brilliant hack with all of that, but yeah.
Okay.
All right, and Sylvan, I believe you have a thing you have to jump off to now?
I do, sorry to say. See y'all soon.
Okay, all right. In that case, I will end this for everybody else, unless, Joe, do you have anything you want to discuss with just me?
Nope.
Okay, all right then. Thank you, everyone, for coming. We didn't get through quite everything, but we got through most everything, and I think that was a pretty good conversation. And I'll talk to everybody later.